You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Oh, hi, my name's Jackie Morton. I'm retired detective chief many, many years ago now, but always carried on being interested in crime. I've just written a book called The Real Prime Suspect, which is shortly to be published. Yeah, for the past 16 years, I've been a volunteer in a male prison down in Surrey, helping men recover from addiction issues and working with them.
I'm Sue Clark. I've just retired from Lancashire Police after 32 years and ended up, well, one of my last subsequent roles was head of crime, and the current one that I've just left, which I shall be returning to, I hope, I was head of the Lancashire Violence Reduction Network. So again, from myself's brief conversation with Jackie this morning, is around that real focus on believing, of, you know, the hope in recovery, trying to get help people make the best of what they can be in their lives, and seeing a lot of examples of that. And it really inspires me to kind of keep moving forward. What I've learned from the, certainly the last few years of working with a number of brilliant people who are in recovery, is that that humanness and seeing people as they really are. And a real interesting conversation around policing and how often we're not who we are. We don't want people to know who we are, because that provides us with a bit of vulnerability, I suppose. It exposes you to vulnerability.
Yeah, well, that's a crikey, you've brought up so many things there, haven't you? You know, this modern-day era of social media now. I want you to see me, but I don't want you to see me. I don't want you to see the real me. I want you to see the image I want you to see. And there's all that, isn't there? But I was really delighted when you both agreed to come together, because I think, and we're all on the same page here, Sue and Jackie, you're very similar in outlook and character.
I wish we'd worked together.
I do.
Been a fantastic team.
You know, two women that have been hugely successful in the police, I would say, despite the hurdles that perhaps have been thrown up against you. But what fascinates me is that you're two women from a different generation of policing. You know, we talked about women in policing. There's not nearly enough women yet in the police force today. So what sort of things did you find that became obstacles to you?
Well, as you said, David, I'm much older than the lovely Sue. And I joined, you know, the police 52 years ago. So it was a completely different era where women were in a separate department, nothing to do with the men. Sexual Discrimination Acts and Equal Opportunities had not been legislated until the mid-70s, which kind of changed things. We worked in what they were called special inquiry units, which were dedicated units to women and children, basically. As I matured, the value that these women officers, their dedication, their knowledge of children, families that were struggling in Leicester city centre and all around. And I was a bit like almost, you know, slightly dismissive of it, because I wanted to be integrated to the men. And it was only when I got older and more mature and I realised the value of that particular work. And in when the acts came into play, some of the women officers didn't want to be fully integrated. They want to carry on doing what they did. And I can see
the sort of architects of their own future, weren't they? I
suppose. Architects of their own future. And it was a valued commodity that those women officers provided, because they knew the difficult families. They had great relationships. Remember then that we didn't have social services, so you had everybody within the social services. We know it now. They were specialised officers, so you'd have a specialised mental health, you'd have a specialised child protection officer, and they were all specialised, and then, you know, then they all kind of went in one big pot, if you like, and you did lose that specialisation. And they were dedicated teams working extremely well together. And, you know, partnership that we now know as partnership was operating way back then in 1970.
Yeah. How about yourself, sir?
Well, people like Jackie made people things a lot easier for people like me. I have to say that. It's true. And
right.
And I hope that I've done similar for other people. And I think it's a constant thing.
Evolution.
Yes, it is. But it is appreciated, and it really genuinely is. Because I was telling my husband the other day about when I first went on CID. First of all, I was pregnant when I went for my interview, but I didn't say anything. In case they thought. I wouldn't have got, probably wouldn't have got on if they knew I was pregnant. So I was vomiting on my way into the interview, deposited a plastic bag of vomit in the nearest waste paper bin, and then tidied myself up, went for my interview.
Nothing's changed, not at all.
And then they told me I'd got on, and then I thought, I'd ravaged with guilt, thinking, God, I'm going to have to say it at some point. So there'd been a double murder in Preston, and a DI at the time was inside. It was some days after, and he'd gone back to visit the scene, and he was inside. I thought, I'll have to tell him. So I waited outside, I was pacing up and down. And when he came out, am I allowed to swear? Or you can block it out, can't you? I was waiting outside for him anyway. I said, boss, can I speak to you? And he says, yeah. I said, I'm pregnant. And he just looked at me like, it's fuck all to do with me. And he got in his car and drove off. And I thought, oh, I think he took it quite well. I was like, I'm so relieved. And then I was having twins. And one of the lads said, you can't be pregnant. You're on CID. So the women who were on didn't have children.
Yes.
Mostly didn't have children. And they were WDCs, that's what they call, that's what they were referred to as. Because I had twins, I had to go part-time. And nobody wanted me back on CID because I was wanted to be part-time. So these were things that they just took for granted. And one of these guys said to me, having kids, it's like having a dog. You shouldn't have them if you're not willing to look after them, as he drew on his fag, because he could all smoke in the office then. Yeah. So it was a case of trying to, because I'm an only child as well, I always think I'm kind of aware of how to blend in what's going on around me and trying not to upset anything. And I suppose you just kind of felt your way through it.
That's interesting, that, because I did a podcast with Alfie Moore, who's an ex-police officer turned comedian. He's very funny. But he said he would see comedians that weren't getting a laugh and they were basically dying on stage. So they would then tailor their performance to the audience and perhaps go down routes that, are a racist tone or a sexist tone. It would get in the laughs. And it was like the comedians were doing this set then, but they didn't really want to do it. I suppose it's a similar thing, isn't it? Yeah, you kind of change your attitudes and your values that perhaps necessarily aren't yourself.
I think
just to fit in.
It's interesting that, because I don't feel that I ever did anything that I wouldn't look back on now. I think, but it's just stupid things like they all smoked in the office. And at lunchtime, you had to play dominoes.
Oh, go on, I know the story.
That's such a funny story.
You had to play dominoes and you had to hold them in your hand. I can't really show, obviously, it's on audio, but you had to hold them across in between your two hands. Yeah. So I could never quite hold them all in my hands. And anyway, this day, they're all smoking. it turned out I won. So I'm like, they were like, God, the birds won.
Yeah.
Then when I stood up, there was a double six that I'd dropped, and it was in the folds of my skirt, and it dropped on the floor. But then I think I got accepted more then, because I think they thought I was blagging them.
Yeah.
And actually they thought, there was something about this
we
girl. Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they thought I'd tried to blag them, and it was just my ineptitude holding these bloody dominoes.
Brilliant.
But I can remember feeling anxious, like, oh, God, we've got to play dominoes. Or if I had to play cards and I didn't understand the rules of the game, it's literally more stressful than dealing with an armed robber was working out the rules to nomination or whatever it was. I'm like, literally, I used to think when it came to rest time, like, oh, God.
You do feel like a trespasser in another world, that you're not party of. You are part of it because you're there working with them, but you're still... You're looking in from the outside, if you see what I mean. But funny you say about being pregnant. When I joined, women couldn't be a serving police officer and have children.
No.
So that,
really? Mm. Well, so if you'd had like kids 2-3 years old, you couldn't.
Well, I don't know about that situation, but if you married and you became pregnant, you couldn't serve.
Yeah.
Having given birth to the child. That's it, finished.
Wow, I didn't know that.
One of my good friends who joined, I joined the team that she was on when I first joined in 1990. She'd had to resign.
Really?
Mm. She did come back, actually, once they changed the...
I remember seeing a photograph once. I think it was the Met, but it was like a typing pool. And it was full of WPCs, as was there, in their uniforms and hats.
Typing. And on a Saturday and Sunday, when this sounds really archaic, but it is what it is, you had switchboard at Leicester Central Police Station, which was the biggest station in the middle of the city centre. And you know, there's kind of answering the calls with your headphones.
The
cable in the socket. So when the switchboard operators didn't work the weekends, then we did their shift.
Right.
On the switchboard.
Yeah, I used to do that. Yeah.
Men never did it.
Really?
Every night, when I was on nights, they'd give out who was doing what. My column number 6055. And the sergeant used to go, 6055, comms. I used to think, what the absolute hell. God. And then my mum died not long after I'd been in the police, only about 8 weeks in. The first death I dealt with, which was a lady.
Yes.
I happened to be working with this same sergeant who used to always put me in comms on nights. And we went to this death. I always remember it was an old man, and his wife had been married for 40-odd years, and his wife had died suddenly.
Yes.
And I had to take him to go and see her. So I was filling in the form, you know, as you do.
Yeah.
And then we went to do the ID. And I held in his hand, and he was crying. I was crying, and this sergeant's looking at me like, oh, Jesus Christ, you can't even bloody write fill a form out without crying. Like, what the hell? And then I took him to see her, and he got hold of me. He was only a small man, and he got hold of me, and he was sobbing, and I was holding on to him. And afterwards, I said, oh, I'll walk back to the Nick. The sergeant was in the car, and I said, I'd walk back, but I broke my heart in a door, shop door, where I just stood in this shop door and broke my heart, because... Yeah. It kind of all
triggers yourself.
Out.
Yeah, triggered
me.
But
that was like showing that vulnerability. Then was like, oh.
You just didn't.
No.
So it's for what you both have said, then basically you've had to fight discrimination just purely because of your sex. And it sounds as though you've been a bit, it's been traumatic for you, just having to fit in because you want to be one of the guys, and you're not guys, you're women. And that must have been a pressure.
It is what it is. So the police operate in that way, and then that you join the police and you will kind of fit in. So there was no flexibility of thought. It's just carry on as normal. But now you've added women to the mix, and what you're going to do with them. And
I suppose that's like passive discrimination. Have either of you encountered, overt discrimination?
I think also it's very important, and I think it's important to say as well that it is all in context. So the police aren't aliens that have landed from another planet. So when you look at where women were in society in 1970,
it was a reflection, wasn't it?
It's just a reflection. Definitely. Across the board. So the police are not... you know, doing anything that was different to anybody else. And I grew up in an era where women didn't go to work. My mum didn't go to work. My dad went to work and my mum brought up the kids, and everybody was the same. Very few women worked in any what you would call a profession.
Yes.
And that's the way society was. So it wasn't intentional, I don't think. It was just they'd internalised.
That's the way people were brought up, I suppose, isn't it?
And I feel a bit uncomfortable when I use the word discrimination, because... to me, that's just how it was.
Oh, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we all see an experience through our own lenses, don't we?
And do you know what? Recently, I'm talking in the last, probably 7 or 8 years ago, we were all I was a superintendent then, we were on a management, like a training course thing. And in my little syndicate, they were all saying how the culture's changed. How nothing, you know, everything's all right now. It's kind of backslapping each other about... that our old modern,
yes,
cool with everything and all this. And I said, oh, I don't think it's that, it's just not changed that much. They all paused for about 20 seconds, looked at me, then carried on speaking like I'd not said anything.
Really?
And the only one person there, one of the guys said, oh, that was interesting. Sorry, Sue, you don't think. So I said, no, it's not. Things like, we're going to a meeting. I said, when I'm driving to work, I don't watch football, I don't understand the rules, but I'm listening to the sports news to find out something that I might be able to join in conversation about.
Right.
And it's not their fault, that. And they were gobsmacked. And I said, so I'm like on my way into work thinking, like, when Leicester won, you know, and remember that.
Unintended consequences, isn't it?
So they were like, oh. I said, and you're all like texting each other across the table and obviously having an... please don't start talking about Strictly Come Dancing on my behalf just because of me. But it's just, this is how I experience it. Do you know what I mean? It's not that you do, they don't, it's not intentional. Like you said, it's just how it is.
It's innate, isn't it?
So
it?
They were really gobsmacked.
What was that book? Is it Men Are From Mars and Women
yeah,
Are From Venus?
Something
or
like
something?
That.
They explored that, didn't they?
But I just think, well, I don't think it's necessarily discrimination. I think it's other people, it's our own vulnerabilities. I could overlay my own anxieties on some of the things that have happened to me, but also the people that have displayed that behaviour to me would have had their own stuff going on.
Absolutely.
Some of it's about their own insecurities. And this is why, going back to talking about working with people in recovery, why I love the people I work with, because it's so honest and, you know, we're all crap in different ways.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I've learned, and it's probably down to you, Jackie, to be honest with you, in the years that we've known each other, that, you know, when someone displays some upsetting or nasty behaviour towards you, it's, you know, I was always would assume, well, what have I done wrong? But it's never about you. It's always about them in the end and the reason how they react.
It's about if kind of 10 people walk in a room and I say, hi, Dave, how are you? And the 10th doesn't. And you think, oh, I wonder what I've done wrong. But we're not, you know, it's not about us. It's about, as the dog died of, you know, is something upsetting in their life. And you just have to detach yourself from it and not take it so personally. Because,
and in an indirect way, it's quite selfish for you to take, isn't it?
It is a selfish.
You know, it's all about me.
It's all about me, me, me. So the point is, it's just acknowledging that somebody's not, you know, feeling right at that particular moment in time.
Right, Jackie. Well, one of the reasons we're here today is because you've written a book.
Mm-hmm.
You've become an author. And for people that don't know Jackie, she was the inspiration for Linda LaPlante's TV series and books, Prime Suspect, D.I. Jane Tennyson. Her book's called The Real Prime Suspect.
I did it with a ghostwriter. It's very important to
say.
Yes,
Helen Mulholland.
Elaine Mulholland.
What brought you to the point of wanting to write a book?
Part of it is a bad age, knowing that I've got less years in front of me than behind me. The other thing is I have been in recovery for 2 months short of 30 years.
When you say recovery, that's alcohol.
From addiction, yeah. So I've been a member of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, for nearly 30 years, and I've got a Master of Science in Addiction Psychology. I feel older and wiser. I feel quite, grounded as an individual. I've done quite a lot of looking, at our shadow side of self that we all have, and made that unconscious drivers that we all have conscious. So I'm a reflective person, and by chance, and we say in AA, there's no such thing as coincidences.
Okay.
I'm sitting with you two. There's no such things as coincidences. That Elaine Mulholland spoke to me about something else.
Mm.
And out of that, the idea that came out and said that I felt now in a position to be able to write down my memoir and feel confident in my own voice. And so that's the reason that I decided to do it now.
It wasn't a book that you could have written 10 years ago.
No. Probably not. And I don't know, I wouldn't have, you know, since Prime Suspect, for example, you know, I have been asked to write a book on a few occasions and I never felt quite right. This time it felt right. And the fact that I did it with Elaine Mulholland is such that you are trusting your life in another person's hands, that they interpret your voice and what you're saying correctly, that they don't bring their own agenda to the table. And it's a real skill to capture another person's voice and the nuances.
I'd be interested, how does that process work?
Well, it goes back and forth, back and forth. So sometimes I'd write it, sometimes, most of the time she'd record me. Then she would then put that down on paper, then she'd send that to me. Yeah, do a draft, and then we just bat it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, till we got to the you know, to the core of it, the actual truth that I was happy with, because it is about interpreting another person's world. And as you know, the police is quite a complex world, and how we deal things is just like police jargon and all that kind of stuff. So that process, all in all, it took 18 months, took a year to write, and then 6 months with the publisher going, they bring their stuff to the table, obviously, what they want more of or less of that.
And was there a danger that the essence with that process, was there a danger that the essence of what you wanted to say was lost?
Well, there's always a danger of that, and there were times that we disagreed, but we're two mature women who batted it out, you know, intelligently and with maturity. And there's a guy in my village where I live called David Young, and he's a very big publisher in his day. He's retired now. And he gave me some brilliant advice, and he said, Jackie, every time you go into a bookshop, when your book is finished, you pick it up from the shelf, you open it at any page that you are happy with every word that you have written, because once it's in print, it's in print, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I remembered his wisdom and advice, and I would always use that and say, no, I'm not happy with it, it's my story. And Tulane understood that. So it was, you know, okay. Yeah.
Was there any parts of the book that you found difficult? Because I appreciate you have your memories, but when you actually start writing them down and looking at them forensically, it can trigger emotions.
Well, the addiction part's always difficult. So I'll say this. Nobody grows up in life with the ambition of being an alcoholic. Nobody would do that. It's mental torture. And the fact of self-hatred and remorse, and more importantly, shame, is so prevalent. So, I'm a product of the 50s, came out gay. I was the only one in the police service that was out gay.
You had a bit of a time of it, didn't you?
Yeah, there was some tough journey along the way, and I used alcohol to numb. Now, I'm not proud of that, but I am proud of it now, because, as I say, I've been in recovery 30 years. My recovery has made me the person that I am today.
It's taken you to a place that perhaps you wouldn't be otherwise.
Somebody said in AA one day about themselves, and they said they wouldn't have amounted to much if they'd not been an alcoholic in recovery. And you know what? I get that. You know, I've failed the 11 plus. I've been in recovery. I've got two masters. I've been given an honorary doctorate by London South Bank University. And the shame that I had about that 11 plus was phenomenal. And out of that, you get something else.
Yes. I read something in the book, I think, and it was interesting what you said, was that it wasn't your experiences in the police that led you to alcoholism. It was obviously all the other experiences, and I suppose that, you know, it's the old saying, the straw that broke the camel's back, perhaps.
Yeah, I think there were incidents in the police that accelerated my drinking, but I'm not blaming the police for being an alcoholic. I could have been, you know, a journalist, or I could have been anything. And would I have been an alcoholic? I'm never going to know that. Yeah. But I became one, you know, I'm in recovery. My life, I am not that person anymore that drank all those years ago. I'm just a completely changed woman. Not because of the, you know, I don't drink. There's a million and other things that recovery allows you to be. And Sue's already touched on that when we were talking before we came here having a cup of tea. It is about being open about yourself, and having that vulnerability to share with another human being, this is how I'm truly feeling.
And be comfortable with
it. And be comfortable with it. And the work that I do in prison, I've been in there 16 years. I have met many, many murderers, people that have committed violent offences, robberies, all in addiction. And they say the same thing, virtually. Underneath all of this, Jackie, I'm a frightened little boy. And the rest is the mask. The rest is the facade that they put and the acting out, because intrinsically they're scared.
Sue, have you ever thought about writing a book?
Well, you know, this is, you know, Jackie said earlier, there's no such thing as coincidence. Yeah. I have actually, but not more of a fiction based on reality, because I have, from the perspective of, I was a single parent for quite a long time. Yes. I was on CID, and
I don't know how you did that.
You're trying to make everything work, aren't you? And this is why the girls, when I got remarried, and my husband is a good cook, they were saying, why can't we have proper food? And they meant chicken Kievs. You know those pies in a tin, Ray Bentos, they meant them. They said it's like fucking MasterChef every night because he's like making proper food. So, you know, you do it all, don't you? You manage to get through that. The best parts of being in the police, I mean, we've discovered we've got a sort of mutual friend, as it were, this morning.
Well, just you should say, not by name, but
no.
Sue investigated a murder and I picked the person up in a recovery programme.
Yes, and I'm really, that's really made my day to know that that's happened because I could see...
That's a bit scary,
see that in her... all those years ago, and then I felt sorry that what had happened had happened.
And you could see the potential, couldn't you?
Yeah, you can. You feel it, don't you, really, more than anything. So I was worked quite a long time working with informants, chises as they are known now. But that's when I really took a real keen interest in the human condition because you met them, you kind of saw them, the underneath part of them. And so, particularly street sex workers, I have a lot of respect for them. I genuinely do because, you know, I know people sometimes, it's a really controversial thing, isn't it? Because I was involved in stuff to do with the national approach to policing prostitution. I know women who are sex workers, mainly off street, who choose to do it. It's not me saying that, that's what they say. Please don't try and rescue me. I'm happy doing this. This is what I do. But I think I'm right in saying mainly the street sex scene, it's not as prevalent as it was, is fueled by addiction. And I've met some people who I got to know very well over the years who used to speak to us about things. And, you know, one particular woman, I remember eventually she told us that one of her punters had asked her for a child. He wanted access to a child. And basically, as part of, there was some behaviour of her own that made her, she wanted to tell us the information, but how she'd come about it reflected badly on her.
Because was it some form of acting out?
Well, yes. Done? So he'd been coming to her house.
An acting out on her part. Yeah.
And also there was some photos of her own daughter there and he was doing that, using them. So eventually, because it didn't all fit together, she had to open up and that she felt shame of that. So this man was a teacher, as it turned out.
Oh, my God.
So what she did was a massively brave thing. Because she told us what she needed to tell us.
Because who's going to believe a prostitute on the street corner?
So there's lots of covert stuff went on around that job to put in an intervention. So the idea of the book, I've thought, was kind of...
Don't say too much, because somebody might pinch your idea.
True. But
they don't have her experience, so that's the essential thing. People, that's the difference.
So to me, it's the similarities of us all, whoever we are.
Well, it's strange. I mean, you said out, nobody sets out to be an alcoholic. I don't think nobody sets out to commit crime. It's circumstances or a life path.
It is a choice for some.
It is a choice for some. There are very few genuinely evil people.
Yeah,
I agree.
And the ones that are about, they are the ones that deserve to sit in jail for the rest of their lives. But I think the vast majority of people are just you and me.
Yeah, they are.
And each one of us could have turned to a life of crime.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not holier than thou.
Definitely not.
And I think some people forget that sometimes, and certainly a lot of police officers forget that.
Yeah, and I think that this is why I introduce a lot of people to the policing environment who've come out the other side, because we need to feel that there's hope. Mm. We need to feel that people can change.
You have to give people hope. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
When you joined the police, you did 32 years. When you first joined as a young officer, did you still feel the same about people, crime and vulnerability then? Was it a thing that evolved within you, or was it when you were older and more mature that you looked at it through a different lens?
I think I had an interest in people, why they do what they do, and probably thinking, probably more from a rescuer perspective, even if, you know, whether it's somebody that you're dealing with in the cells or the victim, thinking you're trying to help them. But it was a very, I think it meant, then I became more like, well, let's bang them all up type of thing when I was working on like target team squads and stuff like that. I think the my interest in the recovery world and seeing people, person underneath, has only come later on. Because you sort of think, well, what's it all about, this? And this is why, you know, we talk about, people talk about building more prisons, don't they? I was going to Wymot Prison recently, and along the road around the corner, there's all these signposts outside the people's houses saying no third prison. And there was an old lady in her garden. I wanted to stop my car and go, I agree, no, we shouldn't have a third prison, but not for the reasons you don't want it, because it's in your backyard.
Let's just put the right people in the prisons we have.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you know, you hit the nail on the head, the amount of people in prison. I'm not saying you don't have to, you know, take the consequences of your actions, because everybody does, but how much of that could have been avoided is huge. And that's why, I challenge people who have that kind of strident view around, you know, build more prisons, shove them all away. And I recently met Priti Patel, and that was a really interesting encounter, actually, because Stephen, one of my friends in recovery, he told us very, he didn't have a lot of time, and he did it bang on. He just told the essence of the bit that she needed to know. And I could see that made a real impact on her. You know, she listened. You know when someone's genuinely listening and when they're not.
But you've been in a job, you know, 32 years. We've all been in the police service for long periods of time. And when I joined in 1970, the thing that hasn't changed is government. And what government wants are short-term objectives for long-term problems in the period of 5 years that they're in government before another election. So the short-term objectives will never work where we have long-term problems. And that's just recurrence. And that has never changed.
No.
Well, it's the old saying, isn't it? You know, the person that plants a tree will never see it grow up, but the next generation will be able to sit under its shade. It's a similar thing, isn't it? Politicians aren't doing anything. They need to see results so the electorate will vote for them. Mm. But some things need to be put in place where they're not going to get the credit for that. Mm. That stops them from doing it for all the obvious reasons.
The current work on the violence reduction, it's not because I'm not saying it because I'm doing it, but the government are funding a lot of really nuanced projects.
Yeah.
Project Adder that I was involved in Blackpool, reducing drugs deaths. It's tackling the root cause, but you've got a lot of people working within the system who don't want to do things in a different way. They want to sign up, you know, do their little bit and push that person, often a person or a family, to another agency. Well, you're not my remit, so off you go. And they get bounced around and people don't have a voice. They're not going to challenge the system.
Well, the system becomes the priority, not the person
designed
to help, doesn't it?
And it's about responsibility. Nobody wants to take full responsibility for something that will make the difference. Because if you're just, I've done my bit, join the dots, I pass it to Sue, she does her bit, you're actually the person that you're dealing with is anonymous. They don't exist.
Well, I remember Danny podcast, and Danny was his next drug addict, doing brilliant work now. And he said he hit the nail on the head. Nobody showed him any professional curiosity.
No.
You know, nobody said, Danny, why are you like this? And he said, if only somebody had said that, he could have opened up.
And that's the thing, you've hit the nail on the head. It is about curiosity, to remain curious. Well, hold on a minute, let me think about this. Why did that happen?
Yeah.
It's the same adage I've told you before. A little kid keeps throwing a brick through a window of the stepfather or something. Did you throw that brick? Yes. Thank you very much. Why did you throw that brick? It's a different answer that will open up a huge can of worms which needs taking hold of.
Well, that very nicely takes it on. I mean, one of the other things you have in common is the fact, obviously, Sue, you're doing the Lancashire Violence Reduction Network, which is addressing why people, I suppose, or being open to that, the reasons why they are committing crime. And Jackie, I know you're going into the prisons as a supporter and counsellor. Is that the right word to use?
Well, counsellor's a bit grand, but
you deal with life as something.
I'm a trained therapist, but
by anybody's standards, committed some pretty horrendous crime.
Well, murder's the worst thing you can do to another.
And I think that's where there's a commonality between the two of you, which I find interesting.
Yeah, I think you obviously see people, you might say, at the lowest ebb, but also at the point where there's some flicker of hope, and encourage that hope that so everybody needs to have hope, don't they? Everybody needs to have hope.
We'll say it's the last thing to die, isn't it?
Hope. Yeah.
One of the ones that I always found really interesting guy, and his name's Kevin, and he was hooked onto the fact that he was abused by his mother growing up, and that was true. He kind of used that as a way that prevented him from changing within. And one day he said to me, he was very bright, he said, you know, Jackie, intellectually, I know I have to let that go about my mum, because I can't keep blaming my mum, I'm an adult. So he said, but what will happen is if I let that go, who will I be?
Yeah.
Because he'd hung on to that.
It's identity.
Identity for decades. Anyway, we worked together on it and he managed to let go. So when he was released, I'm still in touch with him. He's got a long-term partner. And he took me to meet his mother and I met her. She subsequently died. A little frail lady having oxygen, and the love that he had for his mum was just wonderful to see.
Mm.
But he managed to let that go. Now, he could have carried on being a victim for the rest of his life. This is what my mum did to me, da 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 da. But he realised, I'm an adult, I have to let that go.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
And by letting it go, he grew into himself.
Fantastic.
Jackie and Sue continued to share their policing experiences with each other. We all discussed that age-old question of whether we would do it again. Perhaps Jackie summed it up best in the closing paragraphs of her book. Despite some misgivings about the institution that I once worked in, I would join again today. Being a police officer is a job like no other. We deal with the human condition and all its complexities. It was a privilege to have an insight into the behaviours of mankind, both good and bad. Police officers never know what their day will bring, hour by hour, minute by minute. They confront danger without a second thought. The nature of the work can be exciting, stimulating, and sometimes make you despair. My message to anyone in the police force today, or indeed in other walks of life, is plough your own furrow, even if the ground that you are tilling seems unyielding at first.